It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're hearing the official song of the Soccer World Cup, We Are One, by Pitbull, featuring Jennifer Lopez and a cast of thousands. The big games start tomorrow with a match between host country Brazil and Croatia, and there have been massive protests around Brazil in the run-up to the event.
Our next guest has followed soccer since before it was cool here in the United States. In a new book, he looks at the sport's global appeal, its rise here in the country, and the dark side that often accompanies it around the world.
George Vesey is a longtime sports columnist for the New York Times. His new book is 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. George, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to be on with you.
Well, you were an early adopter of soccer by U.S. terms. Tell us about your team in high school in, I think it was the 1950s.
The 1950s, hard to imagine. Well, the team was okay. I was terrible. And I was on a team with many different ethnic players from all different nationalities. So we all had different styles, different languages, different outlook on the game. And I did get to watch from behind because I was a defender. I would see all these guys out there playing different styles, and then the opposition would come and run right around me and score goals. So that's all I knew about soccer until I went out to 1966 and saw the documentary of the 1966 World Cup. It came out a little bit later, and it was just such a great thing to see West Germany playing England in the finals, and I was hooked on the concept of the World Cup. I didn't know anything about the World Cup until after 66, but then I got hooked on it.
That's what got you into the game as a spectator and ultimately as a journalist.
Really, it's one of the great documentaries. It's not easily found in the United States. It's called Goal, and it was written by Brian Glanville, great writer, still with us in living in London. I talked to him recently, and he did such a good job of making it sound like the 1960s in a sports venue. There was lots of nice, cool jazz and very tight scripts and short skirts on the women and these mysterious teams, very Bondish, coming in off the planes. And he was right on top of the soccer end of it, but also the feeling for these different countries. And he never made it sound like a replay of World War II. I mean, when West Germany plays England in the finals, you don't have the sense that this is, this is life or death. This is, as he says, it's a football match.
Well, football, or soccer as we call it here, has gotten a lot bigger in the U.S. since you played in high school. Why were we Americans reluctant to embrace the sport for so long, and then what's turned that around?
You know, I'm not an evangelist for the sport, and I don't say, well, people should have discovered it, they should have done this or that, because we have so many great sports in this country. I mean, make a list of them. So for it to take a while, because we had the baseballs and the basketballs, and obviously American football, you had teams, fans waiting, but didn't know they were waiting for it. Then the world caught up with the United States by coming in not through the writings of reporters, not through common sense or good taste or anything like that, but just the fact that people began turning on the cable television and the internet and became aware of things like the Premier League and Champions League. And then the United States started to get a little bit better in soccer, and fans could have something certainly worth rooting for.
Outside the U.S., why is soccer the world's sport?
It's a very simple sport. My friend Paul Gardner, the British transplant who really popularized, I mean, I was way behind Paul. He was here in the 50s writing about it nearly, and he called it the simple game. And it really is, because all you need, I mean, the game started in England, according to myth. It started with people raiding graveyards and taking heads and kicking them around on some saint's night or other. But whether that's true or not, it didn't take much imagination to kick something round, and or even a sock or a can, and it was the easiest game to play. Then finally they got around to having real balls and shoes. King Henry VIII is supposed to have been the first person to wear cleated shoes for traction in other things that he was doing. But it is the game that grew in England. England exported it through its sailors and its merchant marines and people going to South America in particular. It's one of the reasons why in places like Argentina, half the major teams in Argentina have very English names. Newell's Old Boys or Racing or Arsenal or names like that. So there is a great English tradition. They're very proud of the fact that they exported the sport. It happened to go to South America and take root. And then in the colonies, we resisted it.
maybe this isn't unique to soccer, but in my own experience, I've gotten more interested in it, especially as my kids have taken it up. But at first glance, it's kind of hard to follow. It doesn't seem that exciting. There's not a lot of scoring. Does it take a little bit of soccer literacy to be able to appreciate the game as a fan, as a spectator?
No, I don't like to turn it into a kind of a, gee, if only somebody could think it through and see the true inner wisdom.
You're not an evangelist, I know.
No, but even at that, it's not something that I think, what was it, Louis Armstrong was said about jazz, if you got to explain it, you ain't got it. And if it wasn't Louis Armstrong, it was another, you know, somebody who came up the Mississippi. But it's a wonderful theory, and I don't want to be in a position of explaining soccer except this, that these are great athletes, the ones at the top level, and while it's low scoring and you can't use your hands, that's the old American cliche by old, now dinosaur sports writers, my generation, who would go around bleeding, but you got to use your hands. Americans will never go for a sport where you don't use your hands. So that's a dead theory. To watch guys at full speed, I know in 1982, I already liked the sport. I talked my way into a trip to Barcelona, not hard duty, you'd have to say. And I was there. They had two groups. One of the three groups had Brazil, Italy, and Argentina in it, in some funky little stadium where you could actually see the players. And I was watching. I had a very good seat, like the 10th row. And I was seeing players like Socrates of Brazil and Paolo Rossi of Italy and Maradona of Argentina, and they're moving the ball around, flicking the ball with the outside of the foot, the back of their foot, the instep with their knees, their heads. The ball was moving in different directions, and it was accurate, 10, 15, 20-yard passes through traffic, hitting somebody at full speed. So to me, I expected to like it. I already did like it, but the play was so good that I couldn't follow it. I had trouble remembering who had touched it, what they had done. They were so good, and that's part of it. It's not that it's so intricate, but that it really is a different sport from what we're used to seeing.
You mentioned Maradona, and a guest on our show just a week or so ago mentioned that he, Pelé, and now Lionel Messi, one of the all-time greats, all wore number 10. I think you've met all of them. Any thoughts on meeting these top-level elite soccer players?
Yeah, well, you know, meeting them is relative. I have been around Pelé some, and he's lights up the room. My alma mater, Hofstra University, had an academic symposium a couple of months ago, and there was the great Pelé coming in as an invited and I'm sure paid guest, and he just lights it up. People just like him. He looks terrific in his early 70s. So he's a star. Maradona was a little bit different. He's kind of a chunky, swarthy, obnoxious little guy. His fans love him, and a lot of other people don't love him, but certainly a genius. I saw him make a pass in 1990 in Turin, Italy, a grass skimmer through about 27 different Brazilian players, reaching the foot of his teammate, Caniggia, who scored an easy goal for the only goal in a very tight game between those old rivals. He was a genius. And then Messi today is a different player. He's a finisher. He's somebody, a little guy who breaks through traffic. He's at his best receiving the ball. And frankly, I think he's at his best receiving it when he plays for Barcelona and as people like Andres Iniesta of Spain putting the ball on his foot. So I really don't know how Argentina's always good. I don't know how good they're going to be in this tournament.
Well, it's the eve of soccer's World Cup in Brazil, and we're talking to New York Times sports columnist George Vesey. He's the author of 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer.
And we want to hear from you. Will you be watching the game starting tomorrow? Who's your team, and are you or your kids taking part in soccer here in the United States? What do you make of the protests that have swept through Brazil in the run-up to the game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. See if you can describe the beauty of soccer. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking about the World Cup and the international appeal and sometimes dark side of soccer. His new book is 8 World Cups. You can join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Are you going to be watching the World Cup? Are you pulling for a particular team, U.S. or otherwise? Do you play? 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. George, before we get to our callers, I want to get to the dark side of the equation. And we're seeing protests in Brazil leading up to the World Cup, people displaced from their homes in some cases for construction related to the event. Is this a typical story for host countries in a World Cup match?
No, it is not, and it's a good question. Of the eight World Cups I covered, there was never protesting like this. There were always issues. People are talking about things before when you go in there. But I've never seen the protests that have already taken place in the last year in a country that loves football, loves its patrimony, that talks about futebol. They have been having protests identifying the sport, identifying FIFA, the world soccer body, and the guy who heads it, a fellow named Sepp Blatter. They've identified them as the problem. And for Brazil, not that Brazil is a simplistic place. They've got a lot of smart people. It's a complicated country. But people have identified FIFA as the reason why their bus fares are going up. They certainly know that they've had to pay for the stadiums that are being built, for the roads, for the transportation going through, and they are not happy about it. And through the use of social media, and I don't have to tell readers of listeners to your station what the social media mean, you know, Tahrir Square and Taksim Square, and now you've got essentially Brazil Square, people talking about the indignity of having to pay for somebody else's party, even if they will ultimately watch the games, root for Brazil, be happy when Brazil wins, but they're making the point that they don't like being rented out. So the dark side really is organizations like FIFA, the International Olympic Committee, coming in and making demands for high intensity, high value stadiums and other things. You know that FIFA has become the joke in Brazil. People make jokes about, since they're having to pay for FIFA-level stadiums, FIFA-standard stadiums, they now want FIFA-standard transportation and FIFA-standard medical care. So FIFA, for the first time ever, has become an active, raging joke in the country where it's gone to make its money. And I would say this way, FIFA has been found out.
And FIFA and scandal often appear in headlines together. Is there something fundamentally wrong, opaque, mismanaged about the organization?
Opaque is exactly the word. It's the most opaque sports organization I know, and we've got a few in this country. We've got, well, the IOC is important here, but the NCAA, the National Football Concussion League, with not paying any attention to the damage that it was inflicting on players for dozens of years. But beyond that, they are more responsible to the general public than FIFA. FIFA answers to nobody except a very small group of people who run it. Most of them have been kicked out in the last few years. And that leads to the subtitle of my book. It's called, the subtitle, The Dark Side of Soccer. And I wasn't planning to do that much of a take it on the dark side of it. I was going to mention it, how Blatter was something of a character and he said dopey things and you couldn't quite make sense of what he was doing. But in the last few years, a number of officials in FIFA have been thrown out, have resigned or quit under pressure, whatever the reason was, for financial improprieties. It goes up to Blatter's door, doesn't get inside. It's one of those scandals where you wonder how all these terrible things, bribe giving, bribe taking, could have gone on without Blatter having a clue. Of course, we don't have to look very far in our own domestic politics for many, many examples like that, where you kind of cement yourself off from the reality. But Blatter has been tarnished terribly in this, and yet he's threatening to run for office again at the age of 78.
I want to get to our callers, whether they want to talk of the beauty or the dark side of soccer. We'll go with Willem and Colfax first. Willem, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to be rooting for the Netherlands in the World Cup, and the first game in their group on Friday is against Spain, which will be a like a repeat of the last title game of the World Cup, Spain versus the Netherlands, and they're both very good teams. Spain is incredible, their precision, their passing, everything. And that's another thing that's interesting about soccer is that there's so many different styles. The Germans are very tactical, precise. You know, the English, they're long passes. They're sort of more open approach. So a lot of different countries have a lot of different styles, and it's interesting to watch that. It's interesting to watch it because there's no breaks. You know, there's no huddles. It's continuous action. And then you can kind of see them trying different things to pierce the defense. And then you can almost see it coming when there's a goal, like, oh, they're going to make it this time or whatever. And so it's and to me, it is a beautiful game, and I love watching it.
Willem, thanks so much for that call. And, yes, there are times where you can just see, you know, the whole world standing up from their seat saying, is this going to be the moment? Your thoughts, George, on what Willem had to say.
Well, that's a terrific comment. That is happening in the years that I've been following soccer. I've gotten a little bit better at picking up on the trends of a match. And now in recent years, I've been able to watch, and exactly as the gentleman says, that I can see something change, that there'll be a difference. Instead of the ball being down on one end, it'll start to move up, or there'll be open space, or a team. And you know, they're very smart athletes, of course. They're trying to exploit these areas, and suddenly they find a way to get it over into that area, to put an extra man in there, to run a pass off it. And you do get the feeling of the tide changing, and you sort of anticipate a goal. I'm not surprised. The other day, the United States was playing a friendly against Nigeria, and you could just sense that Nigeria, A, wasn't really into it and wasn't playing very good defense. And the U.S. began to surge and scored two goals.
Willem, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Fulvio in Milwaukee. Fulvio, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to step into this conversation because I have a little bit of identity crisis in this coming game because I'm originally from Italy.
Classic for soccer fans.
I'm originally from Italy, and you know, I grew up with soccer being a very big thing. And as a child, I just you know, kicked the ball wherever we could. If it was not a ball, it would be a tin can, but. It was culturally is a very strong thing. Then I moved in the States about 30 years ago, and so I became, you know, an American. And within these 30 years, I actually was married to a Brazilian woman. So at this point, you know, in the coming games, I really don't know where my team is anymore.
Fulvio, thanks so much. And George, you were saying this is that identity crisis is common.
I love that. Fulvio, I knew from when I heard your first name, I was sensing that you were going to say you were Italian, because in fact there was an Italian player a couple of decades ago, Colavatti, I believe, and he was a World Cup level player. But I know the name. If it's true that people can root for different teams, I call myself in the book, I do a whole riff on how I went into the World Cup in 82. Of course, the U.S. wasn't good enough to qualify, and I was sure that Brazil was going to win. But along comes Paolo Rossi and the Catenaccio and the Contropiede, and they wound up winning the entire World Cup. And that made me an Italian fan. I heard that beautiful anthem, the little tarantella, four different times, and I became a kind of a wannabe Italian. So I have this kind of opposite reaction now. I'm a loyal American, born and bred here, but I love when the anthem is played. It just makes me happy. I think of those Azzurri shirts. I think of Baggio, and I think of Toto Scalacci and all that. So it's very possible. I call myself, or any soccer fan can be, a soccer bigamist, that you have engagement. You have love of different teams. I think it's okay, Fulvio. I don't want to sound like you know, Dr. Ruth or, you know, some love counselor, but it's really okay.
Fulvio, good luck to all your teams. Go to Chris in Sheboygan. Chris, just a few moments left. What did you want to bring up?
I've been to three World Cups, Korea, Germany, and South Africa. I got to tell you, it's the greatest experience ever. You get to enjoy your time with fans from all around the world, all different colors and sizes and shapes and different styles of football. I'm actually on my way right now to coach a U13 club team, and soccer is all in our family, so we're spending a lot of time during this period cheering on the Americans and hoping they get a little further than that first group of death, and we're really excited to have the World Cup coming on television.
Chris, thanks for the call. Good luck to your club team. George, he's hopeful for the U.S. team. Are you?
Not really. I think they're in the group of death. They're in a tough group. They have been playing well, and they have their own little controversy of Klinsmann leaving Landon Donovan off the team. Klinsmann is a smart guy. I respect his intelligence. I respect his personality. I don't think he's doing anything to be mean, but he doesn't think that Donovan would be the right guy to have on the club. I think he's wrong, but he's not a fool. So we'll see. It's not the only problem the U.S. has. They have a back line. They've got to beat Ghana in the first match. Then they have to get a point here and there against Portugal, against Germany. It's a very tough task.
We'll leave it there for now. George, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, and thanks for the great questions.
That was George Vesey, sports columnist for the New York Times. His new book is 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at what's happening in Congress with Paul Singer of USA Today.
First, we're talking to a Wisconsin Republican about the news that House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost the primary election for his congressional district last night.
I know there's a lot of long faces here tonight, and it's disappointing, sure. But I believe in this country. I believe there's opportunity around the next corner for all of us.
Congressman Cantor yesterday, Tea Party candidate Dave Bratt surprised the nation and won that primary election. Bratt, an economics professor and former seminary student, argued that Cantor had lost touch with basic conservative principles.
Brian Schimming is with us in studio to talk about this primary result and what it could mean for the Republican Party at large. He's the vice chair of the Republican Party in Wisconsin. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So were you as shocked as the rest of the country about Eric Cantor's defeat last night? What was your reaction?
Yeah, well, kind of a surprise. You know, I've been talking to folks the last couple of days in Washington. I used to be out in Washington a couple times a month. And, you know, there was some chat about it, but no, I don't think anybody thought in Washington that it was going to happen. So it did come as a surprise. But, you know, when there's the narrative today, obviously, is a lot about the immigration issue. But, you know, from what I've seen of it, and I've seen a fair amount already today and others, it was immigration. But there, a real anti-Washington sentiment there in his district, not unlike the rest of the country, but certainly in his district. And when you're an incumbent in leadership, you pay for that.
So you're seeing it through the lens of immigration. Is that being the primary driving force behind the defeat as opposed?
Well, I think a lot of people are chatting about that today, whether, you know, that was the issue. And I think it'd be foolish to say that it didn't play a role. Although, from what I've seen, that was by no means the reason that Professor Bratt ran or that he was really an active member of the Tea Party or anything like that. But that's the narrative. The Democrats are always trying to raise money off the whole Tea Party narrative. And hey, that's their job. That's fine.
Well, one of Dave Brandt's biggest talking points during this campaign was that Eric Cantor had lost touch, he said, with conservative principles. Do you think voters agreed with that?
Well, could be. What's interesting, actually, about this loss is I think when you're in leadership, it's nice to be in leadership, but you have to take responsibility for everything that happens as well, and you don't control everything that happens. So I think part of that was with Cantor, maybe lost touch with his district a little bit. What's interesting is you look at the other primaries this year, Lindsey Graham won a landslide last night in, frankly, more conservative South Carolina. And Lindsey Graham is an open immigration reform supporter. Look at the difference between this race and that race, Senator Hatch and Senator Lugar. Senator Hatch, a reform proponent, but he won his election. Senator Lugar went down. John McCain, a couple of years ago, open reform supporter. He won, and his anti-immigration opponent went down. So it's not, I think, with respect to the immigration issue, frankly, the party is where most of the country is, and that is they don't want open borders. They want the law to be followed. If there's going to be immigration reform, they want a process for people to get to legalization. So, yeah, I think immigration played a role, but I also, with the perspective of these other races, I would say, you know, it's a measured role as well.
So if we look at the Tea Party narrative, which is what some people are also talking about today, that being that establishment Republicans not resonating as much their policies with voters right now, and that voters want to see more of what the Tea Party has to offer. What about that angle? Is there something there?
Well, I think the Tea Party, a lot of folks active and a lot of folks who are not partisan that were active in the Tea Party, and we've welcomed them into the party, as I personally think we should. And I've campaigned around the state, and I travel the state still for a long, long time. So I'm glad Tea Party activists are out there. But I think, again, when you look at the other races, not just Cantor's, but the other races as well, that that's an interesting narrative for the Democrats, but it's less interesting in terms of where the Republican Party is. I'll say this, too. Given the situation that we're in right now in this off year, not a presidential election this year, but in this off year, I'd rather be where we are than where the Democrats are right now. I mean, the president's approval rating is upside down. Obamacare is still got a 52% disapproval. 62.8% of the people on the latest poll think the country is off on the wrong track. The Democrats almost have given up on the opportunity to get a Democrat majority back in the House of Representatives, and they're talking about losing the U.S. Senate for the first time in a while. So given the situations of the two parties, I'll take where we're at any day.
Well, let's talk about where the GOP is right now. Is this a game changer in the message heading into the November midterms? Is there going to need to be a realignment of messaging?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a game changer. I think that with perspective, you know, with Washington and the policy, I don't know what happens with immigration reform right now. I mean, I think there was, let's be honest, I think there was going to be an effort in immigration reform. I don't know if that survives this. I think the biggest change might be on whether they do anything on immigration reform. But I think it does give a path and remind folks in Republicans in Washington and across the country that, but not only the Tea Party, even not only the base, but people around the country, and you see this in all the polling, are in an anti-Washington mood. That's part Barack Obama. That's part, you know, folks wondering whether the party, you know, folks in both parties are representing them. So I think it's a message that way. Does it change the narrative for November? No, the Democrats in every poll out there, in the Real Clear Politics polling average, every poll out there shows the Democrats in big, big trouble, regardless of what happened last night.
And what about changing the game plan for Wisconsin races in November? Is it going to change anything here in the state?
I don't think it changes much in the state. I mean, there's a lot of talk about Paul Ryan. You know, he could end up in leadership if he wanted to, although I see
he said he doesn't.
Yeah, and that's not Paul Ryan. I mean, Paul Ryan, and Paul's a friend of mine. He's a policy wonk. He wants to do Ways and Means. He wants to talk about budget matters. So I don't know that it changes anything for him. With respect to the governor, I like where we are in the governor's race right now. We've always thought that the governor's race was going to be close all the way to the end. I still believe that. I've said it in this studio before. I'll say it again today. I'll be saying it 2 weeks from now. This will be a close race to the end. But when it's clear to voters the differences between what Governor Scott Walker had to inherit when Jim Doyle left office 4 years ago and where we are today, terrific, terrific improvement. And the contrast against Mary Burke, with all due respect to Mary, I think is a good one for us.
Now, earlier you mentioned Lindsey Graham in contrast with Eric Cantor, and there are analysts who say that Lindsey Graham took the race a little more seriously, didn't take a lot for granted, was a little concerned and put more into the race, and that Eric Cantor was maybe feeling a little too secure. What would you say to that? Are there lessons there?
I think there are lessons there, and part of the lesson is a basic one, and that is you have to make sure that you're listening to the folks back home. And maybe that was part of Eric Cantor's issue, is he wasn't listening as closely as he could have been to the folks back home, which for him, close, he's from Virginia. But you know, when you end up in leadership, either in state or federal leadership, you need to be pretty conscious about making sure, remember the folks who elected you, and maybe Eric Cantor had a little bit of an issue there. So, and Lindsey Graham just walked all over all of his opponents last night. I mean, it was, in as I say, in a more conservative state. So I think it's a warning to incumbents, probably of both parties, that better listen to what's going on out there.
And one question that's remaining out there right now is, does last night's result essentially move the GOP to the right?
No, I don't think so. I really, in terms of our immigration message, the party is pretty much where the country is. I think the party is open to immigration reform, but the basics of immigration reform that you see in the polling that everybody wants are what the Republicans want, which is to enforce the borders, to have secure borders, to have an orderly process for people to become Americans. And a lot of those same things are what the vast majority of independent voters think. So I'm pretty comfortable with where we are there.
And one last question for you here. Is this the end of Eric Cantor in politics?
Well, I don't know. He's, you know, I look at Eric Cantor. He is a terribly talented guy. He's a relatively young guy in politics. So I never say never on any of these people. He announced today, as you know, that he's going to resign as majority leader. And that's more driven, frankly, by the process. And that is they need to elect a new majority leader that's going to be part of the new majority coming on. So he's getting out of the way, which I give him credit for, frankly. He's getting out of the way and letting some new leadership take over. And that works for me.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, so great to be here.
We've been speaking to Brian Schimming, Vice Chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin.
It's time for a weekly update on Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time, and, well, this time around, his timing is pretty good.
We're continuing our conversation about House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's loss in his Virginia primary last night. He lost to Tea Party-backed and largely unknown college professor Dave Brandt.
It's the biggest news from this year's campaign trail so far. It raises questions about the role of the Tea Party, where the polls went wrong, and what this could mean for immigration reform.
And, Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks. Nice to be with you.
Well, Paul, we talked to you last week, and you said nothing about Eric Cantor going down last night in the primary election. Didn't see it coming?
Yeah, I feel stupid. and I'll tell you, actually, I have some pals who live in Cantor's district who are kind of Tea Party-affiliated folks. And they were telling me back in May that Eric Cantor's going to lose, and I was laughing at them. And they said, no, you know, there was a state, not even a state convention, there was a district Republican convention where Cantor got booed by some of the Tea Party rabble. And so my pals were like, oh, you know, Singer, this is it. You know, this is where Eric Cantor's going down. I'm like, oh, you guys are out of your mind. Cantor's going to outspend his opponent, you know, millions to hundreds, which he did, and he still lost. So, yes, today I eat crow.
Well, I can't really blame you. You and every other media outlet and pretty much everyone else in the country eating crow today. Why do you think it happened? What is your take the morning after?
You know, your previous guest, I think, was right on, is that there's a lot of chat about, well, his position on immigration maybe was offensive to some folks, or, you know, his connection to Washington. But I really think the issue is this. He did not tend to the home fires. He did not pay enough attention to his district. Eric Cantor, as a leader in the Republican Party, was traveling all over the country raising a lot of money for the party. He was a terrific fundraiser for the Republican Party. He was a national brand. He was leading this effort to sort of rebranding the Republican Party and, you know, come up with a new agenda for the Republican Party, modernize the party's agenda. You know, a lot of stuff that kept him out of the Richmond area, and people sort of felt like they were being ignored, that he was not really part of their community anymore. He had gone Washington. And we've seen this over and over again in this election cycle, is that the way you beat a Tea Party challenge is you show up, you spend time on their front porches, you spend time in your community, you listen to them complain, and you convince them that you're really the person they want. If you ignore them or just basically don't tend to your knitting, as we say, back home, they will turn on you because they feel like you're not one of them.
And we heard with Brian Schimming just a bit ago that maybe what he's seeing here is anti-establishment going on in the GOP. You're talking about that same thing here. Does that change the narrative that we've been talking about, that it seems as though the establishment Republicans are doing okay, thank you very much, and maybe they didn't need to be so concerned about the Tea Party? Is that narrative flipped around now?
Well, you know, this gets back again to this notion of national politics and a national narrative. All politics really is local. Each one of these races is a different thing. Overall, the establishment Republicans have been able to succeed at fending off their Tea Party challenges largely by going back to the district, spending a lot of time, and spending a lot of money. It's those couple that didn't, Eric Cantor being one, and in Mississippi, Thad Cochran being the other, who are losing and paying the price. But I'm not sure that this, you know, one election result, this one primary result, turns on its head the notion that the Tea Party is losing its influence. I think what it once again reiterates is that there is a strategy for incumbent Republicans to head off the Tea Party, and Eric Cantor did not use it.
Can you put this into perspective for us? Historically, how rare is what just happened last night?
Never. It has never happened. There has never been a sitting majority leader who has lost his race. Now, there have been other senior congressional members of Congress who have lost. There was a Speaker of the House once, Tom Foley, who lost to George Nethercutt. But it is really, 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 really rare. And in part because incumbency provides you with the tools to win. It provides you the opportunity to bring home the bacon with legislative projects that favor your district. Eric Cantor didn't do enough of that. It provides you the resources to fly back and forth, or in his case, drive back and forth your district regularly. Eric Cantor didn't do enough of that. And it provides you this name recognition that allows you everyone to know who you are. That apparently was not enough in Cantor's case. He was running against a guy who nobody ever heard of. Oddly enough, most of the name recognition and advertising that used the name of his opponent, Dave Bratt, was paid for by Eric Cantor as an attempt to discredit him.
Well, let's talk about Dave Bratt for a moment here before we push on. Who is this guy? He's an economics and ethics professor. What else do we know?
Not much. That's pretty much it. He has been a professor at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia for, I think, about 15 years or so. He gets fairly high marks on rateyourprofessor.com. He's a real constitutionalist kind of fellow. I mean, the reason they call him a Tea Party, he wasn't really affiliated with anybody. He wasn't affiliated with any groups. The reason they call him Tea Party, I think, is that his agenda sounds like Tea Party kind of things, like very limited government, very constitutional-based, some reference to, God-given rights and a religious background. Oddly enough, he's going to be running against the Democratic nominee, who is also a professor at Randolph-Macon College. So go figure. Tiny little college in Virginia has both the congressional candidates in November.
Well, the events of last night have left behind a power vacuum both in Virginia and, of course, in Washington and Congress. What are we expecting to see to fill that void in the House?
Well, you know, Cantor is at this very moment briefing the Republican leadership, and they have a press conference in about 10 minutes to announce his plans, which is to step down at the end of July. And then the question is how much of a battle there will be to replace him. There's the natural progression. There's the next leader in line in terms of ranking is a guy named Kevin McCarthy from California. He's the Republican whip. Is the title. He would be the natural choice to, just by seniority, to move up. However, you know, he carries some of the same baggage of supporting the Boehner agenda and the Cantor agenda in the House, and the conservatives may make a stink that they want someone more Tea Party friendly, more conservative, maybe like a Jeb Hensarling from Texas or Steve Scalise from Louisiana. We'll see. It is yet to be told exactly how contentious this is going to be. Remember, whoever gets this job becomes the sort of odds-on favorite to be Speaker of the House should John Boehner step down sometime in the near future. And if you had John Boehner's job, you'd be looking to quit because it's a miserable job. So it's very possible that this person becomes the next Speaker sometime soon.
And let's talk briefly about the polls here, because part of the reason this was such a big surprise is because of the polls, which were showing Cantor with a double-digit lead.
Yeah, well,
you know, and then we have the opposite happening. What do you think went wrong with the polls?
Well, the only polls that I've seen any real reference to are Eric Cantor's internal campaign polls. Nobody polls these races. I mean, when you have a guy spending this much money against another guy spending nothing, nobody bothers to poll. I mean, there's no reliable polling to count on. So then you're in this question of, and again, you know, this area, this district is heavily rural, and then a bunch of suburban Richmond. Who knows how the internals were doing their polls? My suspicion is they weren't spending a whole lot of money on it either, because it all looked fairly easy for them and fairly obvious. You don't spend a lot of time and energy polling to really get down into the weeds if you think there's not much there to look for.
And one big angle on all of this, as we've been talking about, is a speculation that started within minutes of this news that immigration reform is now dead. And, of course, that this is sort of the noose that hung Eric Cantor, possibly. What's your take?
I think it's dead. I thought it was dead before. I think it's still dead now. There's a Monty Python line in there somewhere. It's nailed to the perch. You know, I think the issue here is whether or not immigration was the thing that killed Eric Cantor. hard to tell, right? It was certainly a campaign theme of his opponent, and it was certainly something that Cantor began to worry about. He began to advertise on the theme that, hey, I blocked the immigration bill. Whether or not it really made a difference, I think it will weave its way into conventional wisdom amongst Republicans that you shouldn't get involved in immigration. It's a third rail. It's going to make it hard for you. I can't see any reason for anybody to try and pass an immigration bill in the next, 6 months before the election. There's no upside for the Republicans.
And Paul, our last 10 seconds, good news or bad news for Democrats?
I think it's got to be good news for Democrats. It gives them something to celebrate. One down, 200 and something to go, right? How bad could that be?
All right, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Take care, Veronica.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every week at this time to update us on Congress, talking about the defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in last night's primary.